Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
What's dominating the picture is there's this weird rolling cloud up the face of the stone. And that is, that's exactly what it is. It's the blast. It's the flame from the blast. And it rolled up the front of, at least from my vantage point, rolled up the front of the building like a dryer tumbling, you know? And it was just a very peculiar thing. It's not yet in color for me, but as I'm looking at it, I start to become aware of colors. It's black and orange, you know what I mean? And then, again, my system's coming back online a little bit at a time. I start to pick myself up, you know, and then it's the office is now starting to break apart. It's cut in half.
On September 11th, 2001, Robert Hoeg was celebrating his first anniversary as a senior executive service employee for the United States military. Members of the SES work in key positions just below top presidential appointees. Hoeg was in his office at the Pentagon. That office was just above where American Airlines Flight 77 struck the massive building on 9/11. Hoeg and three office mates were trapped in the partially collapsed building. Corporal Tim Garofola managed to wrench open the door to the hallway, and they all squeezed through. Hoeg heard someone through the smoke, a voice saying there was a way out, but also that there were at least six offices between their position and the way out, with people possibly still inside.
We can't just run. Every part of my body and mind is screaming, run, you know, because if there's a fire, it's a collapse, it's a shooting gallery. But like somewhere inside of you, you just know if you don't look inside those offices and see if there's anybody surviving in there, it'd be very tough to live with yourself.
Hoeg's office mate, Corporal Garofola, ran in and saved at least two lives, people that were still trapped. Everyone piled into Hoeg's car, and he drove away, smoke in the rearview mirror. Hoeg eventually got home, hugged his wife and daughter, and saw his son, just 12 years old at the time. His son was stunned. And that is when reality set in. Well, 20 years later, Robert Hoeg told that story in that recorded interview you just heard to Thomas Brennan, a Marine Corps veteran himself and an award-winning journalist. Thomas is the founder of The War Horse, which covers the human impact of military service, and he joins us now. Thomas, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me.
We have Thomas's complete reporting on the story of Robert Hoeg, a link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. But right now, Robert Hoeg joins us as well, because he continued serving at one of the highest civilian levels of the United States Marine Corps, and he just wrapped up a 17-year stint as counsel for the Commandant of the U.S. Marines. And during that time, he's seen the Corps through some of its most radical changes, not just the post-9/11 period, not just Afghanistan and Iraq, but internal changes to the Corps itself regarding who gets to serve and fight on behalf of the nation. And he's here to share that 20-year arc with us today. And he joins us from that very same office he was in the Pentagon on 9/11. Robert Hoeg, welcome to you.
Thank you for having me.
I actually want to start with Thomas, if I could, for a moment. What is it about Robert Hoeg and his story that you felt was particularly important for the nation to hear right now, 20 years after 9/11?
I think that his service and his continued calling to serve after 9/11 on behalf of our country is something that has just always stunned me. And far too often, the civil servants that serve alongside service members in the Defense Department go unrecognized. And, you know, one thing that's just been incredible for me to be able to see, both as a Marine and as a journalist, is how the Marine Corps embraced a civilian like him. It was completely unexpected based off my experience as a Marine. And he's emblematic of countless other civil servants that do incredible things on behalf of our country every day.
And a story, like you said, that's not told often enough. So, Mr. Hogue, let me turn to you. First of all, thank you for being in that same office today to talk with us. I know it can't be easy even two decades later. What's it like to be in there?
It's strange, actually. I really can't describe it. The one thing about it is it does kind of hold you, or at least one part of you, in that time period. So it's you're stuck in a moment in 2001, regardless of what year or day it is. But also you have to recognize it's a functioning legal office, and there's business here every day, and you know, there's a good staff and a lot of work to do, and whatever else holds me back to 2001, we have definitely forged ahead.
Well, obviously that day was absolutely horrific. We don't actually need to go over the details more than we already have. So instead, Mr. Hogue, I'd like to ask you, you went back to work the next day on September 12th. What happened that day?
September 12th is, to me, a much more interesting topic than September 11th. September 11th is really kind of a lost time experience of, you know, catastrophe and all the craziness that surrounds an event of that magnitude. And you really, for a while, when you're in the middle of that, you're just a consumer of information, trying to react, trying to save your life, trying to save others and do the best you can. September 12th is more about getting it together, figuring out how to respond, organizing the response, and thinking through the problem of, okay, here we are. I mean, that happened. Here we are. How do we start to step forward? And for me, September 12th starts out with a very early morning drive to the Pentagon. I had received the night before a call from the Marine Corps Operations Center, essentially telling me to come to the Pentagon for a 6 a.m. meeting with the Commandant. There was no place else to go, really. I mean, my offices are in the pit where the fire was, and at that point, it's still burning. The senior staff met outside the impact area, and we made the decision. I say we. I'm a senior civilian on the Commandant's staff. You know, where the Commandant goes, that's where I go. Commandant made the decision. We're going to go up the hill to the Navy Annex, where the Marine Corps had offices, and frankly, where headquarters Marine Corps had for many years actually been. It had only moved down to the Pentagon, I think, in 1996. So there are a lot of history up there for the Marine Corps. A lot of things about the Navy Annex actually reflect the Marine Corps very well. It's an old, crappy building with leaky windows and bad plumbing. So that's the place we went. And at about, I want to say, about 7 a.m., once we had moved up there, it was intended to be a 6 a.m. meeting, but it just because of the movement of people and such and the gathering of the staff, we all packed into a conference room there in the annex, very large conference room, packed to the doors with senior military and civilians, waiting for the commandant to come in. And we had been told that the CNO would be there as well. So a lot of Navy presence there. And the Navy had been hit directly on September 11th by the plane. The Navy Operations Center was on the first floor, and they had taken a direct hit. And we knew that there were going to be some bad numbers when the reporting came in. I had not seen it. I don't think anybody had any idea what the real numbers were, but we knew it was bad. So 7 a.m., that's hanging in the air, the expectation of bad news and the surety of bad news. 7 a.m., the Chief of Naval Operations, the CNO, and the Commandant come into the room, and it has a sort of gathering storm quality to it. I mean, you can just feel it. And the CNO walks to the head of the table and, you know, more or less hammers his folio into the table and says, "I want to know who did this. Mm-hmm. I want to know what we're going to do about it." Mm. And that launched a very long meeting, but also what I would describe as, at least for the Department of the Navy, the beginning of the planning of the war. And it's there's a lot to that, which I won't go into, but essentially it's, okay, where are our people and what are our casualties look like? That's fine. We have to take that toll. Now, where are our people out in the field? Who do we have that's available that can steam to the place we're going to need to go to? That sort of thing.
Yeah. Well, let me just step in here for a second and turn back to Thomas Brennan, because Thomas, in your reporting, you also tell a story of another thing that happened on that September 12th, the day after 9/11, and it has to do with the Marine Corps flag. We just got about like a minute and a half before our first break here, Thomas, but could you tell us that story briefly and as a former Marine yourself, why that moment is particularly important in terms of what happened on September 12th?
So after the building collapsed where, you know, Mr. Hoag's office was, there was a Marine Corps flag that was still standing. And what really speaks to me about that moment was that a civilian who volunteered when he witnessed the plane strike and an Army soldier were the ones that rescued a Marine Corps flag. It wasn't about service rivalry. They just recognized that it was a military flag that was about to fall into the fire. And they saw the symbolism in that. So those two gentlemen, you know, and whoever else helped them, rescued that flag, and it began its own journey to outer space and ultimately the Marine Corps Museum in Quantico.
Mm. Well, Mr. Hoag, we've got 30 seconds before the break. Before we move forward in terms of what you witnessed and how the Marine Corps changed over the next 20 years, I just want you to – you were injured on that day on 9/11. So, I mean – can you describe in a couple seconds sort of how you coped on 9, 12, 13, 14, 15, the next week or so?
Yeah, the summary is not well. I had a brain injury and I had my eardrums blown out. I was completely deafened on one side, and that remains to this day, and with significant hearing loss on the other. But that's just one of those things. You buckle your chin strap because it's coming, and that's what we did on September 12th.
Well, today we're talking with Robert Hoag and Thomas Brennan. Thomas is the founder of the nonprofit journalism organization, The War Horse. And Robert Hoag served in one of the top civilian positions in the United States Marine Corps for almost 20 years. And we're going to talk about how the Marines have changed and what Mr. Hoag witnessed regarding that change over those two decades when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. And today we're talking about how the United States Marine Corps has changed over the past 20 years through the eyes of a unique individual, Robert Hoag. He was one of the top level civil servants in the Marine Corps for 20 years. He served both as deputy counsel and counsel for the U.S. Marine Corps Commandant between 2000 and just recently this year. He's now Acting Assistant Secretary of the Navy for Manpower and Reserve Affairs. And he joins us from the Pentagon today. His story is brought to us by Thomas Brennan, who's an award-winning journalist and a Marine Corps veteran himself who served in Iraq and Afghanistan. And Thomas is the founder of The War Horse, a nonprofit newsroom that covers the human impact of military service. And before we get more into how the Corps has changed in 20 years. Thomas, I actually just wanted to ask you if you could tell us the story of how 9/11 is the start of your experience as, in a sense, as a Marine as well. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. So I was a junior in high school when 9/11 happened. So it was really a formative experience for me. But I'd always been curious about military service. Growing up, my grandfather told stories about his time in the Pacific during World War II as a sailor. Like many veterans of his era, he really didn't share much about his time over there. Instead, he just always deflected to a story about how he had tried to enlist in the Marine Corps three times, but they turned him away each time, telling him how skinny he was. And, you know, fast forward to when I walked into a Marine Corps recruiting office shortly after 9/11, I was also told that I couldn't hack it, and that planted the seed, and it kept me going back. But unlike my grandfather, I was told I had to lose weight. So completely different set of circumstances, but ultimately, you know.
And then you went on to serve both in Iraq and Afghanistan. And what led to your retirement from the Marines?
I had served in Fallujah, Iraq, back in 2004, and really that experience led to my desire to want to reenlist and help the next generation of Marines, hopefully come home from combat and leverage my combat experience to their advantage. So in 2010, I deployed to Helmand Province, Afghanistan with 1st Battalion, 8th Marines, where I served as a position commander and squad leader. And I led 13 Marines and one corpsman for a 7-month deployment. And during that time, on a foot patrol, there was a rocket propelled grenade that wounded myself and another Marine, knocked me unconscious right in the middle of a firefight. And I wound up having to be medically evacuated. And ultimately, that led to my medical retirement 18 months later.
Mm-hmm. Well, but in a sense, I mean, insights that your reporting has given people, and again, we've got links to all of it at onpointradio.org, is that Robert Hoag, as a top-level civil servant in the Marines, actually had, in a sense, an impact on your career, Thomas, in the Marine Corps, even in regarding things like body armor for Marines who were serving in Afghanistan and Iraq. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. So a lot of the efforts that he made for the improved vehicle armor and improved body armor, I directly benefited from. We were putting that stuff on the vehicles before we went into Fallujah back in 2004. I traded in my training sappies for training plates for actual, armored plates that would work, during my time in Iraq. He had a real tangible impact on my career, both through the gear and equipment, as well as the cultural changes that impacted the Marines I served with.
Which we'll talk about. So Robert Hoag, for the many people who actually do not know with any depth sort of the structure of the civilian side of civilian service in the Marine Corps, what does the Council to the Commandant do?
Well, Council for the Commandant in my tenure is the senior civilian serving with the Marine Corps. The Marine Corps, obviously, a hierarchically structured organization. It's about command and control for obvious reasons. It's a military organization. The Marine Corps doesn't have a huge number of civilians, something like 25,000 for a force of roughly 185,000, now down almost to 180,000. But the civilians provide the corporate continuity, the corporate knowledge, and bring in a lot of the expertise that keeps things functioning that a typical Marine unit can't. So, for example, you run a training range. Well, you hire a civilian to do that because Marines will come and go. They rotate out. The typical tour is 4 years. Units rotate out, units rotate in. Obviously, leaving it to the unit to run a training range does not provide a sustainable solution. Civilians are also deeply involved in acquisition and finance and essentially personnel management. Those sorts of things that look like corporate functions are largely laid off to civilian staff. And the Marine Corps has about 23 or 4 senior executives. They manage very large chunks of the corporation, if you will. Council for the Commandant is the lead senior executive who helps manage that civilian executive cadre, as well as the 25,000 civilians, and helps run the corporate functions for the Marine Corps as a member of the senior leadership teams.
Right. So you're at the commandant's side, essentially, completely. When you were a kid, is this the kind of thing that you said, hey, when I grow up, I want to be the top level civilian in the Marine Corps?
nobody thinks that. Even when they offer you the job, you don't think that. No, when I was a kid, I thought I was going to grow up to be a basketball star or a football star. But it turns out, even in college, you know, those organizations have ridiculously high requirements for things like talent, you know, so I was out. But when it was offered to me, I actually turned it down. So
you
it's
did. Just,
it's a hard job. Oh, yeah. It's a big job. It's just one of those things where you just have to know this about the Marine Corps. It's a 24/7 job if you're a Marine. If you're a senior civilian serving with the Marines, it's not a 9-to-5 job. It's an all-the-time thing. The phone goes off in the middle of the night. People call you from Iraq. They call you from Korea. They call you from wherever. And wherever the commandant is, if he has questions or needs help, you're there for the commandant. And many times you're out with the commandant. So it's a big demand, and it's tough on a family. I was not anxious to take this job. I kind of thought, hey, before I'm done with my career, I'd like a shot at that. But it was offered to me. It was offered to me in essentially 2004. And I interviewed with the commandant, and he asked me why I wanted the job, and I told him I didn't. I think for the first time, he looked up from his question sheet and realized there was a human in front of him and really took me in that moment. And when it was over, I went back to my office. I was working for the Comptroller of the Navy then, and I thought, you know, kind of dusted that off and thought, well, I handled that well. And then a little while later, the phone rang, and it was the Marine Corps Operations Center, which makes all of his calls for him, more or less. And they said, stand by for the commandant. Well, I stood up. I mean, what else do you do? And General Hagee picked up the phone and said, Bob? I said, yep. He said, you're the guy. And he hung up.
I guess you can't really say no to that.
You can't say no to that. No, you can't.
Well, look, yeah. Through Thomas's reporting of your story, it's clear, though, that there's a long history in your family of actually seeking out ways to contribute and serve the nation, well outside of military service. So I want to play a little bit more from the interviews that you did with Thomas in key positions around Washington. We heard a little bit of your conversation with him from the Pentagon before, but you also walked around the National Museum of the Marine Corps near Marine Base Quantico in Virginia. And while there, you told him about your childhood in Arlington, Virginia, just a few miles from the Pentagon.
So my family was a very Catholic family, 7 kids. You know, all in Catholic schools. My parents didn't have much money, but what they had, they spent on those schools because they were very good schools and they believed deeply in that Catholic education.
And you were coming of age during the national push for civil rights. And in elementary school, the district where your family lived began the process of desegregation, which, of course, involved busing.
And what happened was most of the white families decided they were not going to participate. They were not going to allow their kids to be bused to a school in, at that time, what was called Green Valley, which was a historically black neighborhood.
So most of the white families wouldn't participate, but Robert Hogue, yours did.
My mother felt very differently. My mother's view was that this was the morally right thing to do. We need to participate in this. We need to support this. One of the 7's going, I was the one who was picked. So I got bused for some period of months to Drew Elementary in Green Valley, where I was one of a very small number of white kids in that school.
So that's Robert Hogue speaking to journalist and Marine Corps veteran Thomas Brennan. So, Mr. Hogue, tell me how that experience and the example that your family gave you played into the changes that you helped usher into the Corps many decades later. I mean, we're talking about civil rights here, so let's talk about the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell in 2011.
Sure.
Is there a link there?
I think there's a link there, and you know, it's hard to say it's a one-to-one link, but let me just say my experience at Drew Elementary flipped the mirror for me. It put me in the position of being a significant minority and surrounded by people who did not look like me. And I felt very isolated, I remember. And, you know, there was a couple of tough days there. But I learned a lot. And I'm going to be honest with you, Megan. That experience didn't turn me into Martin Luther King. I mean, I hated it at the time. I was pissed off because I was taken away from my friends at my school and all the stuff that came from. But later on, as I started to look at civil rights as a career issue, for me, my first job was as a civil rights attorney at the Office of Personnel Management. I started to realize that I had a different lens, a different perspective on what a portion of this country was facing. And I have tried to maintain that lens, that perspective throughout my career. So we got down to don't ask, don't tell. How that helped me was to simply say, you know, to the senior Marine leadership, one of the things you have to do is not just talk to Marines, but you have to figure out what the rank and file Marines care about here. If you're always going to put mission first, and that's a completely legitimate thing to do, you have to try to figure out whether or not a civil rights issue is the kind of thing that's going to cause you to lose the mission or to miss the mission. And in the case of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, our solution was, let's get out there and do town halls and poll the force. And we did that. And what we discovered was, you know, when you ask them, most of the young Marines just didn't care. That just was not an issue for them. So it was a tough issue for some of the older Marines. But for the younger ones and the ones that the Marine Corps is primarily focused on, no, that was not going to get in the way of mission accomplishment. And so Don't Ask, Don't Tell inside the Marine Corps went off largely without a hitch. And I'd like to think that experience drew elementary and it carried through to women integration and force, I think probably even more strongly there. I would say that helped me see that the Marine Corps could envision itself differently and still be successful. And that kind of advocacy is what I brought to the table, or tried to. Mm. And of course, I had access directly to the commandant and the senior staff. So I'm saying these things directly to the service leader. And to the Marine Corps' credit, you know, the commandants always listened, always took it seriously, tried to weigh it. And they were very blunt about what their concerns were with me. But it was very clear that they understood that there was an arc of history, that they were involved in that arc, and that they had to change as well. But they had to protect the mission capability of the Marine Corps.
Right. Now, Robert Hogue, I'm gonna press you here a little bit, if I could, because, again, you have literally a unique lens on 20 years in the Marines as a civil servant in the Marines, to the standing at the side of the commandant. I mean, when you said the some of the older higher-ups initially kind of struggled with it, tell me the truth here. How much was that struggle?
I'm bound, of course, by attorney-client privilege. I will just say that there were some elements of the Marine Corps, you know, older senior staff that just were not going to be able to get their minds around acceptance of gays in the military. But you know, as much as the Marine Corps is a hierarchical organization, you know, the person at the top gives orders, well, the person at the top takes orders too. And to the Marine Corps' credit, you know, when the decision was actually made, again, folding that into the daily operation of the Marine Corps really just was not that much of a problem. But yeah, I mean, I have to be honest. There were some days when we had old white men sitting around a table talking to each other saying, how are we going to do this? You know, like, well, the only people that really struggled with how to do it were the old white men.
And then the implementation then, because it's one thing to have a law get repealed, but then the act of implementation, especially through a vast organization like the Marine Corps, is different. But you said it went off without a hitch?
I say it went off without a hitch. Look, I'm not going to lie to you. It's not like there was never a kid got bumped in the chow line or somebody got harassed, you know, in the formation. I'm sure those kinds of things happened. But the Marine Corps is kind of a tough environment anyway. If you're a Marine at all and you get bumped in the chow line and harassed in a formation, that's just Monday, you know. But we didn't have major incidents. We didn't have guys dragged out of the barracks and lynched, you know, or isolated, you know, beaten up, that kind of stuff. I mean, other than an isolated incident here and there, very few of those kinds of incidents actually occurred. And, of course, no lynchings. Mm.
Well, Thomas Brennan, you were retired from the Marine Corps by the time the official change on Don't Ask, Don't Tell happened. But what's your view about how this period changed the Corps anyway over time?
any social progress is good for an organization. I think that it changed the Marine Corps for the better, for it to be, you know, in a more inclusive and open environment. My corpsman that was assigned to my platoon back in 2004 while we were in Iraq, everybody knew he was gay. None of us had a problem with it. Everybody loved Doc. It goes to Mr. Hoke's point about how the younger generation just really it didn't bother us. So we were ready for the change. It definitely made it. It was good to see that gay and lesbian service members could serve openly, and people didn't have to bring their friend to an awards ceremony or something. Right, they could actually bring their partner. And that's been a good change to watch.
Hmm. Well, we are talking this hour with Thomas Brennan and Robert Hogue, getting a kind of unique view of the arc of the United States Marine Corps over the past 20 years. And for any current or former Marines listening, hop on Twitter and Facebook and let us know what you think about the Corps now versus what the Corps was, for example, in 2001, in the days after 9/11. When we come back, we'll talk a lot more about Robert Hogue's role in the ongoing effort regarding women in the Marines, about the military justice system, and about the meaning of service as well. So we'll be back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Seen. Listen and follow Last Seen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. And today we're getting a unique view of the arc of the past 20 years of the United States Marine Corps. Robert Hogue joins us. And for the past 20 years, he served as both deputy counsel and counsel to the commandant, or for the commandant of the U.S. Marine Corps, meaning he was the top level civilian in the Marine Corps at the commandant's side. For two decades, he's now acting Secretary of the Navy for Manpower and Reserve Affairs. And his story comes to us from Thomas Brennan, who's an award-winning journalist and Marine Corps veteran himself, founder of The War Horse, a nonprofit newsroom that covers the human impact of military service. And we have links to Thomas's complete reporting on Robert Hogue's story at onpointradio.org. But let's keep talking about the changes that the Corps has undergone over the past two decades, Thomas and Robert, and I want to hear more about your role and your view of the process of integrating women into combat positions in the Marine Corps. So, Robert, I mean, can I just start with you? Can you tell us, just talk to us really quickly through what you think about how this process has gone so far?
Well, it's been a lengthy process, yeah, and it's still ongoing to a degree. But I will just say that when we were working on Don't Ask, Don't Tell repeal, it was very clear to me at some point that we were actually working parallel issues. The first chapter, if you will, of women, female integration, women in combat, that was happening at the same time, even though no one really recognized those issues were exactly the same in some respects. And so as I started to understand that more clearly, I started to speak to my clients about, hey, you need to prepare yourself because this is coming. At the time, of course, we still had a combat exclusion rule. Women weren't allowed to serve in combat positions, stay away from forward areas, that sort of thing. The commandant listened, to his credit, I think, and we launched a number of studies very quietly, university studies, peer-reviewed, that were intended to lead to published results, so that we had the gold standard of analysis into the question of what women actually brought to the table in terms of physicality and ability to withstand those terrible environments. That was clearly the focus of those efforts. I want to be clear about that, because what was not on the table is whether or not female Marines could lead. There was never any question that they could lead. Of course they could, and that was accepted. But the Marine Corps is a deeply tribal organization that is focused on strength, military strength, individual strength. So that's a core component of every consideration of what the force brings to the table. And anything that doesn't add to its strength is, I think, automatically suspect. When we started to focus on whether women could serve in the combat military occupational specialties, or MOSs, the physical differences were front and center. And so those studies that we launched helped to inform the conversations 2 and 3 years later, when the Marine Corps was coming to the point where it would ultimately request an exception to policy that would allow the Marine Corps to continue to keep women out of those infantry type roles. In the end, that request was rejected. And because we had done the studies, we knew more effectively how to integrate women and how to build standards for the jobs that they would move into. That work paid off in a number of ways. And that was really the result of that early identification of what was ahead of us and the plan to prepare for that.
Can I just ask you, though, just to be clear, what you just said was after a couple of years of analyzing this data, as you're saying, the Corps still asked for that exemption, though, for gender integration. Why?
Well, I mean, Joe Dunford was the commandant at the time, and Joe Dunford is the best person to ask that question to. I, of course, had a role in advising him and helping him analyze the problem. I will tell you, without violating the trust and confidence of General Dunford, that he struggled with it, and because he knew that women were already in combat. He knew that, I think at the time we started down that road, some 85 women already had combat action ribbons, which meant they had been fired on in a combat zone and had returned fire. So he knew they could compete, but he also knew instinctively, I think, that it was a small number, and we just didn't know what that number was, at least until the studies came back. And more than anything else, I believe General Dunford was afraid that it would become a political issue and that Congress would force the Marine Corps to, in effect, lower its standards to make it possible for more women to serve. And so he was afraid that we would wind up in another fight like the Chosin Reservoir in Korea, where the Marine Corps had to hump out all of its gear and people on its back, you know, in sub-zero weather, and that we would wind up weakening the force by adding in a significant element of less physically capable people. I think in the end, the way it worked out, the studies informed the effort enough that we were very confident that there is a component of women out there who can do this work. And as you would expect, because of the physical demands, it's not a large component, but they're there. And frankly, they're better than the bottom component of the men. So adding that physically capable component of females, in a sense, actually improved the physical capacity of the force and brought other things as well. I mean, it's clear that in Afghanistan, for example, we had what was called the Lioness Program. We had females who were allowed to go with some companies into these small villages, and they were able to talk to females in the Afghan households. You have to understand, in that culture, those women were not allowed to speak to men that they weren't related to. So that's 50% of the population, a potential intel source that we couldn't talk to until we added women to those units. And so immediately doubled our intel capacity. There are probably a dozen stories like that. That one's particularly poignant. But over time, it became clear that this was a good move, that this was actually going to contribute something that we didn't have before.
Right. Well, so Thomas Brennan, let me turn back to you, because, again, you've brought Robert's story to us, and just leaning on your service as well as a Marine Corps veteran. Why do you think this process of bringing women into combat positions is such an important process for the Corps?
I think that, you know, especially now that we've seen Marina Hyrule graduate from Infantry Officers Course, and we've seen Maria Dalme graduate, you know, and serve as an infantry woman. We've seen the successes. We've seen what women are bringing to the table, how they're making units more diverse and, you know, maintaining combat effectiveness. Being downrange, I was part of the problem initially. You know, I only served alongside men throughout my entire career, and it took me a while, and it took distance from the Marine Corps to see that there were truly capable, you know, women that could bring some serious firepower, you know, mental and physical, to Marine units. And now that we're seeing the proof of that, with women graduating and thriving in combat arms, it just, it seems like a no-brainer to me now that we're looking back on it.
Mm. Well, we got a comment here online from Natalie Leone, who says, "I've been out of the Corps for 20 years, and I think the country has changed a lot. Not many care about our service and experiences, and I should have stayed in." Well, so this, actually, that's such an interesting way to sort of get to the last part of our conversation today about how much this country actually does care about the men and women who choose to serve the nation through the U.S. Marine Corps. So, if I could, what I'd like to do is play a little bit more from the on-site interviews, Thomas, that you did with Robert Hogue. We heard earlier of a moment at the Pentagon and then at the Marine Corps Museum. And the two of you also went to Arlington National Cemetery. And while you were there, you spoke with Sergeant Major Carlton Kent, the 16th Sergeant Major of the Marine Corps. And Thomas, you asked him to describe Robert Hogue and his contributions to the military.
I could put that into one word. His contribution, servant. He was a servant first. He never thought about himself. He always thought about serving others. So I would put that in a nutshell for Bobby. He's a servant. And he always looked at himself as that. He didn't look at himself as one of the senior people. He looked at himself as a servant. How can I serve others?
And here's how you, Robert Hogue, responded, standing, of course, amongst the headstones at Arlington, that one way to serve is to have a deep understanding of the price of military service on its members and their families.
As long as people are filling these graves, then there's still a tab that we have to pay. Because there's a family out there someplace that's missing somebody. And there's guys out there, men and women, they're doing the job today. Some of them are going to be the next ones out here. As long as we have people out there representing us, this is a price that we owe them, that we have to remain faithful to them and take care of them and their families.
I mean, if we're being honest, you're standing right next to an open spot.
Yeah, who's going to go here? It's a hard truth. You want to have a country, you got to have people who will do this. But you owe them. We owe them.
That's Robert Hogue and Thomas Brennan at Arlington National Cemetery. Robert Hogue, what do we owe them?
Oh, we owe them so much. If the average person, civilian like me, who didn't serve, I'm just at the end of Vietnam generation, who started to become aware of the military during the war, the Vietnam War, didn't think much of it because that was the prevailing social view. A lot of what I've learned here, I really have learned for the first time. One of the things I've learned is just from observing and participating, what it takes to field a force to go out and do these things. And what we ask that force to do, something that Thomas can address far better than me, but to go out into those really gritty, terrible environments, in some cases the worst environments you can imagine, where Marines are dying to your left and right, and to still go forward, you're asking another person, another American, to go do this for you, in effect. And if people could see it that way, they would understand more clearly, I believe, that we do have a continuing obligation to support those who go forward in our stead, the young man or woman who's carrying that rifle for me. And And I think we need to take care of them. We need to make sure that they have the best equipment, the best training, the best support, that we've welcomed them home, we've cared for their family in their absence and provided health care. We've helped them rejuvenate themselves after the fight, and we've stepped in to repair them where they've been badly broken. Hmm. That requires a lot of investment and a lot of people, yeah. But it is what we owe.
I want to ask both of you, do we also owe them a justification, not just a justification, but a meaningful justification for what we are asking them to do? And I'm saying that because, you know, Iraq and Afghanistan. And last week, we talked to several veterans who are very conflicted about the meaning of the sacrifice they and their fellow service members made. And they're not sure it was worth it. So, I mean, have we as a nation adequately done that for them, given them proper justification or reasons or meaning for the sacrifices we've asked them to make in those two particular places? And Thomas, I'm going to turn this one right to you because you served there.
I think that I don't think we'll ever get a straight answer. I don't think we'll ever know the full truth about, you know, why things went wrong in Iraq and Afghanistan. You know, for me, I've been very conflicted, you know, having watched the Marines, the corpsman, the soldier that were in Kabul and died during the blast. I've stood in those crowds like that before. I've known that danger. And I think that, you know, my justification for why I did what I did and why I served, it wasn't for winning the war. I mean, when you are two of the boots on the ground, I mean, it's not really a concept that you're paying much attention to. Like, my justification at the time and how I'm choosing to look back on it is that, you know, I fought for Jim. I fought for John. I fought for Dustin. I fought for Doc. Like, I fought for the people that were, you know, beside me and who were fighting for me. That was my justification to make it through the war and to start a school and to help kids. And to, you know, we tried to do good with what we could, and you know, we did some bad as well. You know, there's collateral damage, it's war. And I'm not trying to downplay the loss, you know, civilian casualties or the loss of life, but it you know, we were fighting for each other. War is terrible. War is heartbreaking. It is absolutely, it's just horrible. But behind the gunfire, like, there's a love for one another, that in my eyes was my justification for, you know, reenlisting and continuing to serve, and, you know, why I think it's important to tell the stories of veterans and their families and the sacrifices that they make.
Well, Robert Hogue, we've only got about a minute left here, but I'm going to ask you as well, if we're going to honor the service of the men and women of the Marine Corps. I know this puts you in a little bit of a tough position because you stood at the side of the commandant for 20 years, who has to take orders from the commander in chief, but maybe we ought to not send those men and women to those dangerous places based on lies.
Well, yeah, tough one to answer. But let me answer it this way. We need a military, and we need a military that can go out and defend national interests. And to Thomas and to Natalie Leone, frankly, thank you for your service. You did what was asked of you, and every American needs to try to do what's asked of them. I served here. You served there. God bless you. I value your service. And yes, we do need to have a clear understanding of why it is we would commit American assets, in particular American lives, because frankly, I look at the investment of the people and the killing and wounding as an investment. That's American blood. If we're going to invest it, we need to understand what we intend to accomplish and what we intend to have happen at the end of it all.
Yeah.
And whether that was clearly understood here, I just can't say.
Well, listen, we just scratched the surface of Robert Hogue's story, this 20-year story of him serving at the highest civilian level in the Marine Corps. But Mr. Hogue, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And Thomas Brennan, founder of The War Horse, a nonprofit newsroom that covers the human impact of military service. Thomas, thank you so very much.
Thank you.
And we have links to Thomas's reporting about Robert Hogue at onpointradio.org. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.